Session number 14806, Eddie Murray, Reel 8.
Met up with a lady, Madagascar lady, girl. I suppose she was about 18, maybe 18 or 19. Mm. And, you know, behind the Methodist church, you know, we spent 2 or 3 hours together before going for lunch. And, well, I mean, you know, I'd been on board for 3 or 4 weeks then, you know. And so I enjoyed myself very, very much indeed in Madagascar.
And this is in Dakar, no?
No, Madagascar.
Oh, right, okay. Madagascar. Right, let's just go on.
Tamatave.
Okay, we said about, can we just, I'm slightly confused. You were allowed in town for your tooth in Dakar.
No, in Madagascar.
Ah, so nobody was allowed on shore in Dakar, and you didn't go on shore in Dakar.
Yes, in Dakar I went to see this editor friend of mine, who was an ex-legionnaire.
Ah, okay.
Yes, I'm sure I told it.
No, I thought that was in Casablanca.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes, it was in Casablanca.
Right.
I do beg your pardon.
Okay, so Casablanca, yes. You saw this friend of yours.
Now, in Dakar, nobody went ashore in Dakar.
And that includes you.
And that includes me.
Right.
And yet, there were quite a number of officials came aboard.
Right.
And I had it from one of the officials that the British had been so stupid. The Richelieu was there with two great big holes in its bows.
Yes.
Which were caused by a concerted effort by naval aircraft and a naval team that went alongside in a rowing boat in the middle of the night and put limpet mines on.
This was commando activity in Dakar Harbour.
In Dakar Harbour, yes.
All right.
And it's a well-known fact that the Richelieu was put out of commission. It had been out, I suppose, for about 6 months then, but for a further 2 years it was out of commission.
And it was in Dakar.
And it was in Dakar. Right. This was in Dakar, okay. Definitely. But some of the personnel that came aboard at Dakar told me that the British had been so stupid about it. If they'd gone about it in a different way and not required the whole of Dakar, you see, to form up behind General de Gaulle, if they'd just gone in quietly and had discussions and all the rest of it, and not brought the Free French into it at all, they'd have been allowed to take over. The British would have been allowed to take over. But as
right, okay. But I was going to ask you: this was after there'd been a raid on Dakar.
This is after the raid.
After the raid, which was largely unsuccessful, wasn't it? Or
it was unsuccessful.
Very unsuccessful.
Yes,
and the Free French, including part of the Legion, went on, and they had a campaign. I don't know.
That was much later.
That was much later, and then it went into Cameroon and Cameroon. And Gabon, even,
Gabon.
I think. Yes. But that was much later.
That was later.
So Dakar...
Oh, it couldn't have been much later.
Well,
you know, but it was considerably later.
Yes.
In the meantime, you know, we went on to Madagascar.
Dakar was essentially a Vichy port at that time.
It was a Vichy port at that time.
Right.
Yes. Okay. But it could have been converted. There's no doubt about that from what I heard from the local residents.
And when did Marcel Kibir happen?
Marcel Kibir. That took place...
In relation to this?
That took place in... I was in Sidi Bel Abbès, so it was about 1938.
Okay. The bombing of Marcel Kibir.
Yes.
By the Brits.
Yeah.
That wasn't in... That was 40.
When I was in Sidi Bel Abbès. Oh, I'm sorry. And I left Sidi Bel Abbès in 41, so 1940, sorry.
All right.
1940.
Okay. 1940 was myself.
I was thinking about a year before the war rather than a year before I left North Africa.
Okay.
That was in 1940, and that was that was an awful business. I mention it in my book again and go into it quite fully, and Churchill afterwards mentioned it when we talked about North Africa and my times there, and how much he deplored having had to take the action. But after all, even although Pétain and Darlin, who was in charge of the Navy, had given certain commitments, about the procedures if the Germans won and wanted to take over the navy. Darlin, Pétain promised Churchill that the French vessels would be either demilitarized or sent to neutral ports. I'll have to read that up again. But Churchill didn't, he just couldn't trust these people.
No.
And he was quite right. And after all, the whole of the burden of the war, was on his shoulders. And he had to make decisions, and some of them were unfortunate. And on this occasion, of course, Cunningham was there, and there were pourparlers, there were discussions about it. And they received the order to fire, and so they fired, and there were about 1,400 Frenchmen killed.
And so the Frenchmen still talk about it now. If they say you're British, that's in certain circumstances. It's about the third thing they'll say.
Well, the following morning, I knew nothing at all about it. I was in City Bellabes and doing my usual rounds of the town, went to the market for my rum and cassis, and which is blackcurrant, of course, and then came out of the market. No, I was still in the market, and I saw this Madame Chenillot, to whose daughter, of course, I was, and son, I was giving English lessons, and I was often invited there for dinners, do you see. I'm sure that they thought that Lucienne, the daughter, who was, a couple of years my junior, that there could possibly, be a relationship between the two of us. And I was called, the nice, kind Englishman. And but I saw her in the market. She was doing her shopping. This is at perhaps 7:30 morning, 8 o'clock. And so I raised my kepi and said good morning. And she turned her face to the other side and walked on. Well, this was most unusual. I mean, we'd been friends for 2 or 3 years then. Really friends.
Yeah.
And so I stopped and turned around and watched her, and she marched on for about 10, 15 yards. Then she stopped, and she turned around and came back towards me, and she said, she asked me if I'd heard about the Mirza Kabir business, do you see? And I said, no, madam, I haven't heard anything. Well, she says, from this day henceforth, she said, I want nothing at all to do with you, and don't come to the house, and don't speak to me ever again. So I went and bought a newspaper, and there it was, all this business of Arzu and or Mirza Kabir. And I accepted the fact that it was a terrible, terrible business as far as the French were concerned, and that it was the British that had done this calamitous business. What could I do about it? I wasn't in it at all. It wasn't my fault. Nevertheless, if she didn't want to speak to me, didn't want me to go home, well...
Don't darken our thresholds again.
Yes. And so I walked on. And a couple of days later, in front of the Continental Hotel, I walk along the boulevard, main boulevard, and there, coming towards me, is her husband. Now, he was in uniform, major of the territorial army, if you like, you see, and he'd been called up, and he was a... Artillery, I think he was. But they were both head teachers, do you see, and he was the boss of the school, and she was the headmistress of this quite good school in City of Labès. So, of course, I saluted him very correctly and made to walk on, carry on, and he replied to the salute, called me over, Venizisi, come here, Monsieur Muret, come here. So I went up to him, stood to attention. I mean, I was a first-class soldier then.
Sure.
And first-class position, which is quite different. And stood to attention. And what's this business, And he shook hands, offered his hand, so I was obliged to shake it. And so I said, after the affair of Arzu or Mirza Kabir, and such a terrible act where so many Frenchmen died, I felt that it was... incumbent upon me, to act this way, not to come to your house, and just to, take a low profile, if you like. And so he said, nonsense, nonsense, you had nothing at all to do with it. You know, what are you doing tonight? Well, I said, I'm on guard duty tonight. Well, he said, tomorrow night I want you, you know, for dinner.
Huh?
And he said, and if you if you don't come, he said, then I'll have a word with the colonel, and, you know, of the regiment, and find out why you're not coming. And so I said, well, I didn't want to bring Madame into it at all, do you see? And so the next night, I went there about 7 o'clock for dinner. Gave a lesson, do you see, at 7 o'clock until 7:30, having had my own meal in barracks, do you see, at 6 o'clock. And went there at 7 o'clock to 8 o'clock, the lesson, and then from, you know, dinner at 8 o'clock, and as usual, Madame had made a wonderful, wonderful dinner, a French dinner, do you see, even although it was in the middle of the war. And things were back to normal immediately, but I never mentioned to the major, to Monsieur Chenio, do you see, the fact that she'd told me not to go. And of course, the girl, she was very tall, she was almost as tall as I was, you know, and buxom and beautiful, really lovely girl. Of course, she fell around my neck and that sort of thing, but then, you know, and then after I left Sidi Bel Abbes to go onto the, you know, onto this Far Eastern cruise.
Okay. Just hang on a second, I'll change the tape. Just tell me, did the atmosphere change a great deal in Algeria after the Sidi Bel Abbes, after the Nasser Kabir, the bombing by the British fleet of the French fleet, or the sinking of the French fleet in harbour by the British fleet?
Well, apart from the incident I've just told you with the Cheniers, I don't think there were no repercussions at all, really. I think it was all, you know, people realised that I, being English, had nothing at all to do with the business. And what's more, it wasn't everybody that knew that I was English. My French was so good.
Really?
You know, I could pass for a Frenchman any time.
Really?
But there were certain people, and, you know, I was very proud of the fact that I was English. And so I had let it be known that I was English, but people used to talk about it, and we used to call it a sad affair, misunderstanding and all the rest of it. But when I left Sidi Bel Abbes, this young lady I was been talking about, she handed me a letter, and I read it later, and it was definitely, you know, a love letter. Dear Mr. Murray, think, if you like, that a young lady, a young girl, a young foolish girl, had fallen in love with you, you know, when at first sight, and that sentiments that she experienced will never be reciprocated ever. But it carried on. Don't worry, Mr. Murray. Partez si vous voulez. Go away if you like. I love life too much to play at the Juliet of your Romeo and famous Shakespeare Romeo and Juliet. And I had that letter with me. It was on foolscap, you know.
Right.
She knew that I was going away, so she had a few days, I suppose, to compose the letter. But you know, I carried it with me for many, many years, and I can almost repeat it word for word.
Really? Yeah.
And the remarkable thing is that afterwards, when the British troops, the Allied troops, arrived in North Africa and in Sidi Bel Abbes, she met up with a Polish RAF lad, and she married him.
Oh, really?
And had a child.
Did you?
And then he was a bit of a bastard, apparently, and so they got divorced.
How did you track her down later, or keep in touch with her, or? Bearing in mind you're in Saigon, I don't know where we're coming onto, but Saigon or somewhere.
Yes, but that happened very, very much later when, you know, when I was.
You still had
Churchill.
You had the address.
No, I didn't have an address. She had my address.
Oh, okay.
In London, in England.
In England, so she wrote.
So she wrote.
I see.
You see, to London, and it was her mother that wrote, and told me all about her daughter.
Right.
That she'd married this RAF Pole, and that they'd become divorced, and then they were living in Belfort, and you know, on the way to Switzerland,
France, yeah.
And that she was now married to a professor of English, I think it was, or a professor at one of the local colleges, and they were quite happy. But their address was, and she gave me the address. Mm. Her mother gave the address to us.
Yes,
I think her mother was probably more in love with me than my daughter, you know, but she was quite a bit older. Nevertheless, on one occasion when we went to Switzerland later on, we went on two or three occasions via Belfort, and we went to see these people. And only on one occasion did I see the daughter. Never met up with her husband, but we stayed the night in their place, mm. as a matter of fact, in a block of flats. And she had a brother, and you know, I knew there was a certain amount, quite a lot of resentment in the way she looked at me. But she'd become even more beautiful than she was in City Budapest.
Why resentment?
Well,
because you're
you know, because I'd left.
You've gone away.
Because I'd
gone away.
Absolutely, no doubt about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's something that I feel, you know, that she would have been there for a long time if it hadn't been Indochina.
Yep, okay. Madagascar.
Madagascar.
So you come out from behind the Methodist Church, or whatever it was.
And yes, with a tooth, less a tooth,
yeah.
but with quite a bit of experience more. And
then back on this dreadful
ship. But they're delightful people in Madagascar. Uh-huh. They're like, really like the, I've always found the Indochinese to be soft, like the Bali people and, you know, and people from Laos and Thailand. Wonderful,
okay.
lovely people, until they get mixed up with Europeans and politicians, and then they seem to change. But you know, I've got a feeling about the native population in these various countries that I've been to. I've
in
always mixed
way?
Well,
yes.
and always tried to learn their languages, and I've been mostly successful in all these places.
Mm. And how long were you ashore in?
Just the hours. Mm, just the hours.
Okay.
Well, throughout most of the day, shall we say. But
yes,
I was back on board
by
4 or 5 o'clock.
Right. And you, you're back on this dreadful ship again. And so to got fresh water?
Yeah, I'm just trying to... Tamatav. Yes, that's where it happened. At Tamatav.
Right. And the passage, incidentally, was it very... It was bad time of... It was sort of... Quite stormy. It's
very pleasant.
Southern hemisphere
very pleasant
summer.
At that time. Oh. Now then, at Tamatav.
All right.
At Tamatav, there was. Can I check my papers?
Oh, if you like, yes. Just hold on. Right.
And there, in the harbour at Diego Suarez.
Which is.
In Madagascar.
In Madagascar, which is the correct which you've just looked up, which is the correct name of the town.
Sarana.
Right.
The
yeah. And right, and you were...
And we were on board. So we go up there on the duplex. And I noticed from the deck an American cargo boat, not a terribly big one, you know, probably about the same size as us, as a matter of fact, maybe a bit smaller. So 5,000-ton cargo boat, American, looking very, very clean. And so I went up to Tukadze and I said, you know, they've probably got books and that sort of thing on board, English, you know, that we could use. So, well, he said, you know, do what you think is necessary. And so I called one of the rowing boats and gave him some French money and asked him to row across the American boat with a letter, you see, and I wrote that letter saying that there were several English-speaking lads on board, and me particularly, I was English, you see, and the captain, Tukadze, was English-speaking. Perhaps they had some newspapers or reading material, you see, that they could let us have. And off it went, and it came back. With it came an invitation for me and a couple of my colleagues to go on board for dinner.
That's good, yeah.
And they also brought, you know, a whole bag full of reading of books, you see, paperback books. So I went to Tukadze and showed him the invitation, you see, and he said, all right, yes, but be back by 10 o'clock. Who are you going to take? You see, this is the confidence that Tukadze had in me.
Mm-hmm.
Not because I... just because I was English. He knew he could trust me.
Mm.
So I told him that I'd take Stern and Ross, the English-speaking lads. And so off we went in a rowing boat, which I paid for in French francs. We went on board, and there were only two people on board, twins, both chefs. The chefs were on board. And they gave us a wonderful meal. Of course, it was dry, because all American ships are dry. But we had a wonderful time. And I was able to look at, now, which way are we going? We're going to Saigon. And I looked at maps, and he got out maps and let me have a look at the captain's cabin and all that sort of thing. And we had a superb time there. And I'd seen all the maps and checked up, you know, which way we're going. And then I said, supposing, I don't suppose there's any possibility of you hiding us anywhere, you see. Oh, he said, no, no, he said, I don't think we could do that, he said, because, well, I mean, we're here until tomorrow. And so, you know, in the meantime, if you don't get back by 10 o'clock, then the captain's going to rouse the authorities and they're going to search the ship and they're going to find you and everybody will be in trouble. No, it's quite impossible. So we thanked him, you know, for his, thanked them, they were twins. You know, they were about 6 foot 6 tall, and then they had their chef's hat on, the hats on top. And they were very, very tall lads. But then we said goodbye and off we went. I can't remember the name of the boat. For quite a long time, I did have the name, their names and addresses and all the rest of it, but eventually, of course, I lost them. So I went back with more books and tales and told the captain what had happened, and that was fine. Midnight. Boo, boo. The American ship, I saw it leaving. I saw it had presumably received, you know, word that it had to depart as quickly as possible because of the war situation. Mm-hmm. See, and off it went. And I said to myself, if only they'd hidden us, they wouldn't have had time to find us. You see, we'd have been on the high seas. Yeah. But still, it was one of those things. I didn't regret it afterwards. And so eventually, after the refueling, off we went across the Indian Ocean and through the, where, you know, we're sailing level now. You know, the water situation and the listing situation had been remedied. And so off we sailed towards...
What had caused the list on this boat?
Because the...
But the water was...
Yes. It was just that the fresh water had leaked out or something.
It was an imbalance.
There was an imbalance as far as the ballast was concerned.
Yeah, okay.
And
wasn't a
leak or anything like that. No, not really. In fact, during those momentous times, shall we say, you know, you could fill your brain with a certain amount of information, but there was always the thought of where you were going to, which was primarily the.
Right.
The thought that was in one's mind. So over the Indian Ocean, of course, and nothing happened until we were in sort of Dutch territory between Java and Sumatra. Other people say that we didn't go through the Sundar Strait. They say that we went north of Sumatra and down that way, down the coast, the Malayan coast. But I know for a fact that we did go through the Sundar Strait.
Between Sumatra and
Between Malaysia, Sumatra and, and Java and Sumatra.
Oh, okay.
And so we had, because I'd seen these maps, do you see, and as a matter of fact, I'd made copies of that particular part, because I still had it in mind, together with Ross and Stern, to get to some place where we could join up with the Allied forces.
Where are we in relation now to Pearl Harbor and the fall of Singapore? That hadn't happened.
No, it hadn't happened.
No.
It hadn't happened. And the Americans, of course, were very, very dicey about the whole Far Eastern situation. Mm. They didn't want, really, to get involved until Pearl Harbor happened.
Mm.
But prior to that, they hadn't wanted to become involved in any of the Far Eastern operations that were being carried out by churches like Singapore and Churchill and his business out there. But here we are. So I look at the map. And then I decide that at one place, there was the best place to jump the ship was in a certain area. And so I knew that one of the lifeboats, at least one of the lifeboats, because we'd made investigations, you see, had stores for a week aboard and that everything was there prepared and it was ready. I don't know about the other ones. I was just interested in one of the dinghies. and there was, as I said, Stern and Ross. I don't know whether Schroeder. I don't. Schroeder might have been there. Mm. Schroeder was also English speaking, and he was the one who had been a reader at La Sorbonne. I think he was there at the time. And so we got our heads together and we decided that that's where we were going to get the dinghy out. And, you know, we kept our eyes open, informing ourselves as to patrols made by ship's crew, patrols made by Indo-Chinese officers and NCOs. And so we knew that at one particular time, we'd have about 10, 15 minutes to do the necessary. I think it would have been impossible, really. Mm. There would have been so much noise. But in any case, somebody had spilled the beans, because on the night that we were due to make the attempt, they'd put an armed Indo-Chinese guard on that particular boat.
Right.
In fact, on all the boats.
Right.
And so it was off. Nevertheless, throughout the next few hours, daylight hours, with the sun shining down in the right direction, that is to say, you see, we're sailing east, and so south, of course, was where the sun was. And I had a mirror, shaving mirror, and out of one of the portholes I was sending out an SOS signal. And, I'm English, SOS, I'm English, you know.
Where had you learned Morse?
Oh, in the Legion, everybody learns Morse.
Really?
That's one of the things, yes.
Okay.
And I wasn't, of radio operator capacity, but that came later when I became, because for the sergeant's school, you have to really go into it much more fully. But every legionnaire during his training learns orientation and quite a lot about the stars and that sort of thing.
All right.
And the Morse code. And so, and in fact, I knew it, quite a lot of it, having been in the scouts England, you see. But and so I sent out a Morse signal, as I said, SOS, am English. And lo and behold, that was the first day that we were through the Sunda Straits and then into the South China Seas. I don't know whether they're called the South China Seas there, but south of Saigon. And the next morning, there's a Dutch patrol, sending out a signal for us to stop. And of course, the captain obeyed the orders and stopped. And the Dutch patrol vessel came along, and there were two officers, and two others, came aboard. There were four of them, I remember.
Mm-hmm.
And so they didn't speak French, and so Tokadze was there, and he called me forward to say, and he said, stand by to be interpreter. And so I stood there, and then I told them, I said, as we were going down one of the companionways, they were searching the ship, you see, for war materials and that sort of thing.
Mm.
And I don't know whether they'd received my message. Never did. But there they were the following morning. And as we were going down one of the companionways, I said to them, I said to the Dutch officer, the Dutch captain, I said,
yes, sir, this is Dutch, Royal Dutch Navy or whatever.
Yes, the Royal Dutch Navy, you see. Because of Java and those places out
there.
Warship, yeah. It was all Dutch. The Dutch East Indies.
Mm-hmm.
And so I told them that it was their duty, to take me, at least, as I was English, do you see, to get to an English place as quickly as possible. And they said, no, we've received no instructions, you see. And then I went on, I carried on, supposing we were to jump into the sea, those English-speaking lads that I can trust, you see, or possibly trust. If we were to jump into the sea, and then he said, well, if the sharks don't get you, he said, we would, and we'd return you to the ship. So, you see, even although I'd tried on two occasions, on several occasions, to get away, because I considered it was my duty not to leave the Legion, but to get to British forces.
Sure.
I thought it was my duty, and I tried, but here it was quite impossible. And so we carried on toward Takadze, called me into his office, and he said, it's all wrong. It's understandable, but it's all wrong what you're doing, he said. Because you signed to serve the Legion for 5 years. And so he said, in fact, he said, you've also served up for another year or two, you see, to come to Indochina. Oh, so yeah. He said, you're morally bound, you see, to stay with the Legion. And he said, it's quite impossible in this region anyhow, he said, to get to any of the Allied forces. And so we carried on to Saigon, Ho Chi Minh City now. And there, of course, we tied up alongside the port. And I saw that there were Japanese. And I went to Tokadze.
There were Japanese?
Yes, Japanese troops.
Right, they'd already...
In the port.
Yeah.